Good afternoon. Thank you all for coming. I want to thank folks at the National Cancer Institute for inviting me and having me here. And I especially want to thank Rebecca, whose name is all over the panel, and unfortunately she couldn't make it. And she's home with her brand new baby, and it just tells you, I think, the time between conceiving a panel for APHA is the same as a human gestational period. So we thank all of her effort. The research I'm presenting is actually all hers, and I hope to give it justice. It was a tremendous amount of work, and I'll cover it in about 6 or 7 minutes. I have no disclosure. So this presentation was divided up into two sections. Her section, which really covered research in California on predictors of interest of HPV vaccine, and then the second part, which I was going to talk about, was some of the efforts that we've done in California to promote HPV vaccination. And so I'll still keep to those two sections. So this tells you that I'm not a social scientist. this is sort of a basic framework for why we're interested in the concept of interest beyond just vaccination. And the idea is that you have knowledge, which Kia presented, and also access issues, but really you need the motivation to get the vaccine. And so the research focus was really around interest. The data are from the California Health Interview Survey, which is similar to the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance Survey, but specific to California. It looks at health and behavior, access to care issues. It's a random digit dial survey that's 40,000 households in California. And the original idea was to try to get a sampling frame that allowed counties, our 61 health jurisdictions, to actually be able to look at data for their county. We do it every 2 years, and the data I'm presenting was collected in 2007. There were two samples that we looked at for this analysis. The first is unvaccinated adult women ages 18 to 26, and the second sample was parents who have unvaccinated daughters 12 to 17. This is a busy slide, but basically we looked at three outcomes, and I'll give you the data in a second. We looked at just their interest in getting vaccinated, and so of course they were asked first, have you received the vaccine? And if they said no, they were asked if they were interested in receiving the vaccine. And then they were asked about their willingness to pay for the vaccine or their willingness to receive the vaccine if free or low cost. The predictors or covariates were divided into a number of categories, including the typical sociodemographic covariates like race, ethnicity, education, income, immigration status, marital status. Also, we were able to look at sexual history for the young adult women and then receipt of abnormal or receipt of a PAP test, preventive care in young women, and a flu shot in the past year. And then, of course, your typical healthcare access variables like the type of insurance, their usual source of care, and whether they saw a physician in the last year. The statistical analysis used Sudan, and we have bivariate and multivariate analyses. So this is just descriptive data. It gives you for the unvaccinated adult female population, we looked at about 1,878, and the parents, 2,866. These were parents who had daughters in the home between the ages of 12 and 17, which is the eligible age for HPV vaccine. Similar to the demographic in California, over 40% of the participants were Latino, over 50% of household incomes were more than 200% of federal poverty level, and then these pie charts show the insurance status, and you can see for young adult women, 23% were uninsured compared to only 7% of the parents of preteen and teen girls. And 24% of the young adult women and 26% of the Medicaid or of the parents were receiving Medicaid, which is Medi-Cal in California. So the next two slides are just descriptive data, and they're shown in the form of a decision tree or the way the questions were asked. All of the this is for young adult women, 2,068 young adult women. And remember, this was in 2007, 11% reported they had received at least one dose of the vaccine, 89% reported they had not. So of the 89% who had not received the vaccine, they were asked if they were interested. About 60% replied that they were interested, and about 40% were not interested. And importantly, of those not interested, over a third actually had never heard of the vaccine. Of those interested, if asked whether they were willing to pay, $360 is about the full price without physician visit added, and 41% were willing to pay, about 60% were not willing to pay, and of those not willing to pay, the vast, vast majority, 97%, were willing or interested in getting the vaccine if it were free. This is the same diagram for the parents of unvaccinated daughters. You can see, similar to the data that Jasmine presented, higher rates of vaccination. 19% reported their daughters had received the vaccine. 80% reported they had not received the vaccine. Again, this is in 2007. And of those who had not received it, about 59%, so similar percentage, it was 60% for the young adult women, 59% for the parents. Similar numbers in terms of folks who had not heard of the vaccine. And of course, and here in terms of willingness to pay, a larger proportion, 79%, reported they were willing to pay. And these are parents, and again, if you remember, the many more of them were had private insurance. And 97, 98% were willing to get the vaccine if free at low cost. So these are just the variables, and again, this slide showed you the multitude of variables that we looked at in terms of what the predictors were of interest. And in unvaccinated young adult women, there are only three that were statistically significant. And it's interesting, education less than high school. So less education was predictive of greater interest in getting HPV vaccine, two or more sexual partners in the last year, and so potentially higher risk for HPV, and then having had a flu shot. In multivariate analyses, it turned out none of these variables were statistically significant. Parents of unvaccinated daughters, the variables significant included education, not being married, Hispanic ethnicity, living in the U.S. for less than 10 years, and speaking a language other than English at home, household income less than 200% of poverty, and then flu shot in the past year. And so a lot of these variables are low SES variables, and Latino populations actually had greater interest in receiving the vaccine. The only two variables that remained significant on multivariate analysis were education less than high school and not being married. If we look at the subpopulation who reported that they'd heard of the vaccine, but they were not interested in receiving the vaccine, they were asked why. And it was an open-ended question. And the largest proportion in terms of issues of reasons they were not interested was they just didn't know enough. And again, in 2007, the vaccine had just been approved in the middle of 2006. Other issues were, they believed that themselves or their daughters did not need the vaccine, they were not sexually active, or their daughters were not sexually active. Some were worried about safety. The doctor didn't recommend. They were too old or too young, or daughters were too old or too young, and then too expensive. Actually, very, very small percentage reported that expense was a major reason for not being interested. So some of the study limitations, this is a random digidial survey, and so this is self-report data on vaccine receipt as well as interest in vaccine, and so there's a low response rate for this survey, typical of other random digidial surveys, less than about a third agree to participate. Potentially some social desirability bias, and given the controversy, may go either way in terms of overestimating or underestimating incidence or interest. With the questions were mostly closed-ended questions. Results certainly may not be generalizable to other states. And then, of course, just conceptually, interest may not be the best proxy for receiving the vaccine or ultimately receiving the vaccine. However, some of the conclusions that we were able to draw is that the highest risk groups, and these are the risk groups that are highest for cervical cancer in California, including Hispanics, lower income, and lower education, have the highest rate of interest, which is very encouraging. Lack of information is the major reason for lack of interest, and willingness to receive the vaccine, if free or low cost, was very high. So these are all very positive things. Implications include increasing knowledge through public education, and now I'm learning maybe media would be a much better way, or collaborating with industry as they're doing their campaigns may be a way to get that information out. And then, of course, decreasing costs through public and private funding mechanisms. So part two of the talk, I wanted to give you a very broad overview of some of the efforts that we've done in California over several years now, starting actually before 2005, when the rumors were starting about this new vaccine and there was a lot of controversy. We developed the HPV vaccine work group in California. And the lead agencies included Immunization, STD, our Office of Women's Health, and the Cancer Detection Group. And essentially, we wanted to get together, identify challenges to widespread HPV vaccine uptake, develop strategies to address these challenges, and then provide state leadership and coordination for optimizing cost-effective vaccine programs. So let me give you a whirlwind tour of some of the things we did. So in the area of public awareness efforts, there was a variety of different strategies. A couple of websites, if I have a cursor, this is our California Department of Public Health website, and actually we have a nice little URL, hpvvaccineca.org, and that was developed very early on with our immunization partners. This one is a Spanish, all Spanish language version of dealing with lots of different vaccines, not just the HPV vaccine, and that went live, I believe, in 2009, based on a lot of interest and data showing that this is a really important population to reach. The middle brochure here was developed by our wonderful immunization branch and really geared toward parents, which is interesting that it was. The marketing was geared toward teens, if you all remember, and we really wanted to supplement information that was geared toward parents. Our cancer registry put out a special report on cervical cancer publicly, and then we also do this wonderful preteen vaccine week, and we're gonna start to do it a couple times a year where lots and lots of local health departments get on board and do health fairs and really raise awareness around the preteen vaccine platform, which doesn't just include HPV, but also includes Tdap and a meningococcal vaccine. We also did a number of provider education efforts, including brochures and information packets that went out to providers. This is me on a webinar that we did with the immunization branch. And then we collaborated with the California Medical Association Foundation, and they had some industry funding to create a toolkit and a website with lots of different resources around funding mechanisms, billing codes for providers, lots of incredibly useful information. In terms of access and financing, one of the things I was asked to talk about is, Jasmine actually presented the national data for 2009, 44% of 13 to 17-year-old teenage girls have received the vaccine. Well, in California, it's actually a little bit higher, it's 49%, and in Los Angeles County, it's 64%. And so we're doing something right in California, and Dr. Breen asked me to talk about some of the financing mechanisms that might explain that. Well, a couple things here. We have state law that requires managed care plans, and as some of you know, California is known for managed care. So lots of health insurance plans are considered managed care. They're required to cover the ACIP recommended vaccines through the age of 18. Certainly by the end of 2006, the first year the vaccine was available, in our surveys and our analyses, most private providers also included the HPV vaccine as a benefit. In terms of the public sector, of course, vaccines for children is administered through the state health department, and those vaccines were available as early as December 2006. And then in 2007, it was actually the beginning, the first part of 2007, Governor Schwarzenegger allowed Medicaid, or Medi-Cal in California, to expand coverage for the HPV vaccine up through age 26. And so women up through age 26 who were receiving Medi-Cal were also able to get the HPV vaccine through those benefits. And that probably went into effect in the fall of 2007, which is toward the end of our survey, which may explain some of the disparities in vaccine uptake. In terms of monitoring, and this was covered a little bit already, in California, it's unclear whether we're going to be able to continue to collect data through CHIS, the data I presented earlier, but we do have the California Women's Health Survey, which surveys adult women in California, and we've been able to, on an ongoing basis, have questions around HPV vaccine receipt. And then in terms of HPV-related diseases, certainly we have a robust cancer registry for cervical cancer. We have some pilot projects looking at cervical dysplasia, which is precancerous cervical lesions. And then we have access to billing data with Medicaid and Family Pact on genital wart treatment and genital wart diagnosis. And so number of different activities where we're really trying to monitor the population-based impact of HPV vaccine. Moving forward, we hope to use the CHIS data to identify target populations for outreach. We want to develop educational materials to improve knowledge and interest in the vaccine, address barriers to access that are ongoing, and of course partner with health coalitions statewide. And all of these are part of the HPV vaccine workgroup activities, as well as now the California Medical Association Foundation activities. And we just had a summit meeting, I think it was just only last week, a statewide stakeholder summit meeting between the two organizations, and had a great interest and still a lot of wonderful enthusiasm. I want to acknowledge folks who contributed significantly to the work, including folks at NIH who helped with the data analysis, Will Waldron and Tim McNeil, as well as Jasmine Tiro, who you've met. Eileen Yamada at our immunization branch contributed to the development of the questions. And then not listed on the slide is my wonderful graduate student who created little visuals and put together tables for me. So thank you so much. I've got our website here and my email address, and would love to hear your questions and comments. Yeah, there's some really good examples of that, and very, very early on, probably too early on, there was some failed legislation in California where I think, you know, too early in the process, before there was infrastructure and public buy-in, some folks had proposed school mandates. So, as far as I know, there's nothing specific to HPV vaccine for a variety of reasons. It sort of is this lightning rod for controversy and pushback, and we have our fair share of vaccine opponents in California. There is some new hope on the horizon. A bill just recently passed because of our pertussis outbreak in California and increasing numbers and deaths from pertussis. A bill passed to mandate for seventh grade entry an update for Tdap, which includes a pertussis. And it looks like from the MMWR that came out in terms of the 13 to 17 year old, about 50% are not immunized for pertussis, which means that mandate is hopefully going to push them into healthcare systems so that they can be up to date for Tdap. And if all goes well in the world, they will also be offered meningococcal vaccine, which is recommended for that age group, and HPV vaccine that's recommended for that age group. And so this will all go into effect in September. So we are starting immediately to try to make sure that providers who are going to be seeing these kids who are not up to date have the vaccine available and are recommending the vaccine to their parents and to the children. And I think one of the biggest challenges, and I don't know if you've seen the data, parents and even providers are more comfortable waiting until age 16 or 17 when they're more comfortable with sexuality issues. And that's going to be, I think, one of our biggest barriers, is to really take advantage of those visits when the kids come in, because those kids are healthy. They're not going to the doctor every year to be opportunistically vaccinated. And so, but we are hoping in the first year of this new law, they're going to target 7th, 8th, 9th, at least 7th, 8th, and 9th, maybe through high school, all the age groups. And so it's just, even this first year is an opportunity to get the 16 and 17-year-old and do all the catch-up vaccination. So we are, and HPV is not mentioned in the bill. It's not mentioned in the law anywhere. It's just sort of, you know, sort of a backdoor way of getting the kids into care and hopefully getting them up to date on all those preteen vaccines. So cross your fingers. Yeah. That's a great question, and they probably still don't know they're higher risk. There's other data that I'm not, and Jasmine may be more familiar with this, but I think in general, Latino populations tend to be early adopters of prevention and medical technology and vaccination. They tend to be a little less skeptical, and so I think that may explain some of it. There may also be social desirability bias. If you ask somebody, you know, are you interested? You know, the default answer may be yes and more culturally appropriate in some populations. So I think there's some different explanations, but we were definitely surprised, and I don't think the data is going to be presented at this panel, but even some of the uptake data, having received the vaccine, tends to be higher with folks in public insurance, which is probably our VFC program, and, you know, access to, you know, other resources, and higher in folks of lower SES, which is great. It's, I mean, because those are exactly the groups that have less access to screening and are at higher risk for cervical cancer. So, but it's different than, I think, a lot of the data that we see on health disparities, and very encouraging. Thanks for coming, by the way. Yeah. The PAP screen, we've looked at this a lot because the PAP screening rates. Right, so the PAP screening rates, not in this population here, the parents, I'm not sure, were asked, or that wasn't analyzed as sort of predictor of interest in getting their daughters vaccinated. But in the young women, I don't remember the rates. We have other data in California that looks at rates. The problem with self-report data on PAP rates is that it's probably a 30 minimum percent overestimate. So if you ask women, have you had a PAP in the last year, we are just more likely to say yes because it seems like it's been a year. If you look at other more valid data sources, it's much lower. And we do have racial disparities, significant racial inequities in PAP screening rates in California. And certainly, I didn't show the data, but significant racial disparities in cervical cancer rates as well. Yeah. Great.
And we found similar findings that less acculturated women, so women who speak mostly or only Spanish, or have lived in the U.S. for less than 10 years, are more willing to vaccinate. And it was interesting, and actually there's a fair amount of literature on Hispanic women and acculturation and general childhood immunizations, and Hispanic women, as they become more acculturated, tend to immunize their children less. So it's interesting to see if this is sort of, you know, lends itself to HPV vaccine.
Thank you so much for that comment. I hope everybody could hear that. It was very articulate. I couldn't repeat it, but thank you.
Given the controversy about vaccines in California and the problem in general that the vaccine has pluses and minuses and issues, do you have any way of documenting the quality of the discussion or that the discussion has occurred around vaccines? Vaccination rate is one thing, but what about the issue of has this been presented, or have you had a chance to talk? Have you had a chance to consider the option?
And are you referring to discussions with providers or discussions within communities? That's a great question. So let me just repeat the question, then I think Jasmine's going to jump in. So the question was just whether we're assessing whether folks are having informed discussions about the vaccine.
A lot of having a young child are getting handed to the EIS data for initial, right? They're trying to do that same approach with the HPV vaccine. It's causing pushback, especially in low-income populations who are suspicious. In Dallas, where I am now, we see no differences between Hispanics and African Americans in their suspicion, like maybe because they're accessing the same healthcare system and they're both having that same cultural kind of expectation and suspicion. The mothers that we're interviewing are very frustrated with the process. They are not high literacy people. They do not have the time to digest information in a complex EIS statement and also be asked 50 million other different questions about how their kid is doing in a preventive care visit. They need time to sit and look at that and to be prepared to have to engage in a discussion, because the doctor asks, do they have any questions? And they're like, I don't know how you begin to sort of ask a question and to articulate something. So they feel very ill-prepared and then say, oh, I thought of something, but it was, you know, a week later, and it's another year before they take their child in. So I think thinking about and measuring the quality of provider discussion and thinking about how we can better prepare parents to be prepared to have a discussion with their provider is what we should be focusing on, and doing some more proactive outreach prior to their delivery.
I think we'll have some time at the end, and we can certainly continue this great discussion. Thank you.